All right, it's just going on 8:15 a.m. on Tuesday, April 14th. You're listening to the Tuesday Morning After on CKUT 90.3. Those were the Democracy Now! Headlines, and beforehand, we began our conversation with Andy Williams about the class that he's about to be teaching at the McGill School of Continuing Studies, the Black Oral Tradition, the Culture, Politics, and Identity of Hip-Hop. And welcome back, Andy. How you doing?
Okay, thanks.
Okay, great. So I want to jump right back in. Before the Democracy Now! Headlines, we were talking about kind of jumping all over the world, talking about the context of the history of hip-hop, and you gave us a really in-depth description, at least just to place us in history. But now I'd like to kind of move the focus to you for a moment and talk about your perspective on this, because you were there from the beginning. I mean, from Derbyshire to New York to Jamaica and back and then all over, you've kind of seen this grow and change, and I'd like to hear what that was all about.
Okay. What I can say is that I remember in grade 11, my friends, Winfield Lewis and Dan Mazurek, we were listening to a lot of radio. And WBLK from Buffalo was the station to go to because it had all the crazy parliament and funky stuff and you know, a bit of hip-hop, which was actually going on at the time.
So this was back in the 70s?
Yeah, we're talking about 78, 79.
Mm-hmm.
And as students of grade 11, we took over the school dances because we were collecting a lot of records. So playing Rapid Delight and playing those early tracks, we were in the forefront of our school playing all that stuff. But what a lot of people didn't know at the school is that we were actually taking trips to various clubs and places in Buffalo, which is just outside Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
It was a version of Studio 54 called New York, New York. And we'd go down there and listen to a lot of DJs who were actually doing that and driving to Hamilton and places in Toronto, Hagerman's, for warehouse parties. Which I would, you know, which I wasn't supposed to be at 17 years old, but you know, that was also the case in England, where you know we used radio as a medium to get our sources,
right.
Our resources, as a 10-year-old kid. So I had a group of guys that we'd listen to John Peel and Jimmy Savile, and so I've always been listening to music like that. And then to top that off, my folks. We're going through a divorce, so Jeff and I, my brother, we were sent to Jamaica, and I went to a boarding school called Clarendon College, which had international students, but on the weekends I'd spend time with my uncles. And one of my Uncle Clive, would take me to see some of the big sound systems, which we called Big Sound, which had all the guys from your Big Youth, iRoys, and Toasters and DJs that we're really familiar with now. So, so I was in the forefront. I got to see a lot of that stuff. Mm. We'd actually follow the we call them Winkies, the fluorescent flies, through the woods. It was like something out of Midsummer Night's Dream. We'd go through the woods, and then we'd come into this big field area where women were dressed in big frocks. The trucks were coming in with the speakers. Next thing you know, there's people selling records on their CB200s, blah, 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 and then the music started.
Wow.
The guy that was in charge of that was a guy by the name of Mr. Brown, who Bob Marley makes references to in one of his songs. One of his title songs is called Mr. Brown. So what I'm saying is that I was there for the Mr. Brown set, which was amazing for a 12-year-old to see.
I imagine so.
So I was there from the age of 12 to 14. But it was such a rich cultural experience to me that it just kept lingering and lingering and lingering.
I guess this is kind of like mythology for some people, but you were a first-hand witness.
Yeah, and to be honest with you, that wasn't my first music of choice back then. I was listening to Slade, 10cc, Mungo Jerry, Sly and the Family Stone,
mm-hmm.
The Stones, you know, a bit of Beatles. I wasn't really a big Beatles fan back then, but I really got to know what it was like for those guys writing incredible songs.
Mm-hmm.
And, so the reggae part was definitely a big influence because, as you know, in England, where I grew up in Derbyshire, it had a big West Indian community. And Derbyshire was the first industrial revolutionary place in the world. That's where Industrial Revolution started.
Mm-hmm.
Because of all the companies that were involved in there, from, you know, your Rolls-Royce, your Concorde, your British Leyland's, British Railway. So there was work for my dad from moving from London. He became a cricket player, but we ended up stationed in Derbyshire.
Mm-hmm.
Because my mom and my dad ended up having a decent life there. So, yeah, so we got involved in the community, and I got to get a big taste of that from the age of probably, I'd say from about 9 to about 12 in England.
Right.
And then the rest of it was Jamaica for sure. By the time I got to New York, it was already a scene. There was already a big reggae scene and sound systems. And then in Toronto, bang, hip-hop.
So if you could pin it down to a year, when would you say that hip-hop really started?
1979 was the year.
And what happened then?
It was just a different change of rhythms. And, you know, we never heard of Curtis Blow before or any of those guys. We were just thinking, wow, what is this? And we paid attention to a lot of the back then we referred to it as scatting, because we were already familiar with that through jazz. So we started scatting, and then the hits start coming out. Most of the hits that were coming out during the 79-80 time period was on Sylva Robinson's label. She's a well-known soul singer. But she was actually responsible for having the movement go further in terms of having that label, Sugar Hill Records.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that was the easy thing for us to do. It's like in the late 80s, I started buying Shep Pettibone mixes, because that was the thing to listen to, because it had a disco R&B house sound. But back in the late 70s, it was the Sugar Hill Records that were, and also Quality Records that were actually, that's the name of the brand, Quality. So Quality Records and Sugar Hill Records were the labels to go to.
So fast forward to now, I mean, this is over 30 years later. How do you think this movement has changed over the past 30 years?
Well, it's been diluted now because of the advertising, because of Information Highway. You know, it's more commercialized. We're not hearing more about the environments anymore. We're not hearing about what's happening in South Compton with NWA. We're not hearing, you know, we're not hearing the lifestyles of these people anymore. What we're getting is a lot of TNA showmanship that sort of bordering on sexuality and nudity.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not really paying attention to a lot of the people's views anymore, because I'm not hearing anything. I'm not hearing that noise. I'm not hearing the noise from your Terrorist Ones or your Public Enemy or Far Side or, you know.
But sorry to interrupt. Go on.
Yeah, so I find it's a little bit more diluted. A good example for that for me is when I used to go to the Rock City Crew festivals in New York. And believe me, there was a lot of Torontonians that I knew there in Montreal, is that we'd all get together in the same area of that festival. But what started to happen is that the banners on the stage were Giorgio Armani, Calvin Klein.
Right.
And then what we'd get is these beautiful young teenage girls walking around giving you scratch and wins. So you'd scratch to see if you win a free pair of jeans. Well, that's not hip-hop. It changed. Totally changed into this commercialism, into commercial, yeah, because it was an asset to the folks and the managers and the producers who were making this.
Right.
They saw the potential of the money that can be made.
Yeah, people can cash in.
Yeah, people can cash in.
So,
even Calvin Klein.
Well, now, maybe on a parallel tack, I want to talk to you about one of the classes that you have listed here. The second to last one is about Tipper Gore and censoring hip-hop. You're talking about it diluting and changing for commercial interests. What about downright intentional censorship?
Yeah, but that didn't last too long in terms of what Tipper was trying to do. It actually helped us. And that happens a lot, whether it's like trying to ban a group's name like Bare Naked Ladies.
Mm-hmm.
That just gives it a little bit more hype. So what happened when Tipper was focusing on that, a lot of people focused in on that, whether it was on the TV screen, whether it was newspapers. It was huge. And, you know, for her being like not the first lady or the second lady, what you're saying, she had clout. So she got a panel together with people like Ice-T, Chuck D, a whole bunch of folks were involved in that. Even, what's his name from Live Aid? I'm drawing a blank right now. But there was a lot of people involved in that discussion, and it was our own identity, and we had to bring that to the forefront to Tipper so she could understand that it's a way of life.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, she just started as TNA. She saw the vulgar, it was vulgar. She saw that it was vulgar, but she didn't understand all that.
Right.
Yeah.
But she wasn't alone.
So what happened is that with that discussion and that debate, it actually helped hip-hop.
Mm-hmm. Do you see that as being in a contrast to the way things have gone now? I mean, you're talking about commercialization as being kind of anathema to the ethos and the ethics of hip-hop. But this downright censorship, or at least the focus that came, seems to have really rallied things.
Yeah, but it actually became poison because we still use those profanities.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes money. Mm-hmm. Those profanities now make money. And, you know, I'm not saying that was the catalyst of it, but in my theory it was. But, you know, it's interesting how we got away from talking about, you know, our oral history, you know, the streets.
Right.
The only thing that actually stayed stagnant in terms of that was the art, the graffiti.
Okay.
Maybe dance, but graffiti for sure still became, it was still there as street. This is part of hip-hop, it's street. Everything else became commercialized, more commercialized.
Do you think that the people who are, I mean, you talk about white suburbia, but I mean, hip-hop's audience, do you think that it's changed significantly? Are hip-hop musicians playing for the same people they used to?
Yeah, that's correct. It's still the white suburban kids that are keeping the sales and music on the charts.
Mm.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well,
is that what you're asking?
Well, I guess so. I mean, the listenership changes. I mean, the impression that I'm getting from this conversation is kind of like things have gone as unfortunately it happens in a lot of artistic movements that rally together people who are oppressed. The gaze from the outside world seems to have gone from confusion to, you know, appropriation, and just it's entertainment. It's gone from being expressive and communicating something for people who for whom it really matters to just being like a spectacle where you can go and get scratch and sniff jeans, things like that. I'm not saying, correct me if I'm wrong, because I am an avowed novice when it comes to this movement, but I'm just, that's the observation from this conversation.
That's right. So what I'm seeing now is that the music has gone in different areas in terms of electronic music to raga to dancehall. All that stuff can be associated with hip-hop.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Will you actually talk a bit about that? The influence of electronic music on hip-hop? And I heard from Micah you're actually playing at Picnic Electronic this summer.
Right. Yeah, I'm doing a set with Scott Steve, and I've got this night with Scott Steve called The Goods that we've been doing for 13 years. And I've played at Picnic. Probably this is going to be my fourth or fifth time. I think it's my fifth time, but we're not really changing much. It's like Bob Dylan going from acoustic to electric. It's still the same words.
Mm.
It's just that it's different. It's just a different format. Mm. Well, we're using a lot of the dance floor music that we'd usually play, but more catered to electronic music. That's all we're doing.
What do you think about the internationalization of hip-hop as well? I was thinking of a Palestinian hip-hop group, Damn, mm-hmm. Who started, they started rapping in English, but they switched to Arabic since then, and they're based in Israel, and they're really important as far as Israeli-Palestinian conflict activism. There's a documentary about them called Slingshot Hip Hop. So this is just one example of a lot of international hip hop movements. What do you think about that?
Well, as I told you before, it's a voice for the voiceless, right? Mm-hmm. We have people now who didn't have a chance to say what they wanted to say and express themselves. And now we have that, which is really important.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So before we have to turn things over to Dragon Root, I just wanted to ask you, you've mentioned a lot of names and a lot of references to different personalities. What are some of the books and resources that you're going to be using in your class?
Wow, that's a good one. There's tons, because I'm even going to be doing jazz. But if you're
a student and you're thinking about signing up and you want to get kind of dip your toes in, I mean, obviously you have to sign up soon because the class is starting up. But like maybe one or two books or things to listen to.
Well, there's four that I'm going to really dive into because they really have different styles and they're pertinent to the course itself. Can't Stop, Won't Stop by Jeff Chang.
Yeah, that's a great book.
That's
yeah.
a good one. That's a great book. Rakim Told Me, which is hip hop's whacked back straight out of the original artist talking about it. The Puerto Rican Culture and Latin Identity from Bomba to Hip Hop. That's written by Juan Flores, who I mentioned earlier. And there's people like Luke Fox. That's worth checking out. He did a book on Ice-T Shot Me in the Face. It's called Ice-T Shot Me in the Face in 11 Stories about Rap. And that's really, really digging right into it. And there's your Nelson Georges. And Nelson George probably writes, I don't know, two or three books a decade, right? He's done so many different books.
Okay.
So those are some of the folks that I'd actually concentrate in discussing in the class.
Well, thank you, Andy. Before we go, I want to tell our listeners how they can sign up for the class. You go to mcgill.ca and / continuing studies. So it's mcgill.ca/continuing studies, all one word. And the class is listed under arts and culture.
And if they want to call about the course, they can call 514-398-5212.
Okay.
514-398-5212.
Thanks, Andy. And what do you have on the docket yourself in terms of performances and nights that you're hosting and shows coming up?
Well, I'm bringing in with Scott Steve, we're bringing in Deanna Sounds from Boston. He has a label called Cultures of Soul, and he runs the gamut. He plays anything from hip-hop to funk to Latin to African music, but all in a dance floor vein, because that's what we do at the Goods. We have people from 20 years old to 60 year olds dancing up a storm, from ballerinas to breakers to you name it, they're all there.
Sounds good.
We've been running this night for the last 13 years. So our anniversary is coming up in August. So that's a big show coming up. Then I'm going to be in Quebec City. There's a whole bunch of things. Jazz Amnesty Sound System, which is another project that I have with Sweet Daddy Love, formerly DJ Love from Ninja Tune. We're going to be doing our Jazz Amnesty project. We're going to be doing that at Casta.
Mm-hmm.
The day before St. John Baptist, which is what, the 23rd? I can't remember. Anyhow.
24th, I think.
Yeah, so the day before St. John Baptist at Casta, that's going to be quite a night. We're getting together with some swing people. There's an organization that does swing dance. And we're going to get together with Didier and his crew. And I think I'm going to open up that set, that first initial set, because it's all like swing music and authentic swing music, I'm saying, not your electro swing, which is actually a big craze right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's festival season, so I'll be touring festivals throughout Europe.
All right. Congratulations. Sounds like a busy and exciting year.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much for coming on the show, Andy. We have to
oh,
we have to stop a very interesting conversation right here because it's time to turn things over to Dragon Root Radio. But it's been a real treat to have you back on the show.
Yeah, I just want to thank you and Tiffany. That's right, right.
Thanks for coming in. Yeah, it's Tiffany. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay. Take care. All have right. a great
time. Have a good one.
You too. Cheers, man.